All right, here's where we left off. It is 483 BC, and King Xerxes has shown all of his glory of the kingdom, placed it on display for 6 months, and at the end of the 6 months, he's thrown a banquet for all the men in his official offices, a seven-day banquet, and his wife, Vashti, the queen, has been entertaining the wives over in the palace for the same 7 days. And at the end of the banquet on the seventh day, how do I say this? Xerxes is totally smashed. That's a great answer. Just smashed. And he decides that he wants to bring in his beautiful wife, Vashti. And by the way, the name Vashti means beautiful. That was not her given name. That was her name that was given to her when she became the queen because she was so beautiful. When Xerxes married her, prior to 486 BC, when Xerxes becomes the king, when Darius I dies, his queen is Vashti. For 3 years, she does just fine. Finally, this banquet happens, and on that seventh day of the banquet, Xerxes calls for her to come. And she says, like a good, faithful wife, no, I am not going to come to your banquet. Now, the text, the scripture doesn't tell us why, but history tells us why. Number one, banquets for men were always for men, and the ones for women were always for women. And in those days, they did not eat together. They ate separately. They drank separately. They feasted separately. Men and women in the Persian Empire were not allowed to be together. Number two, Vashti is pregnant with Artaxerxes I. She will have Artaxerxes that very year, 483 BC. Artaxerxes I will take the throne when Xerxes dies. So Vashti is pregnant. And in the old Jewish Targum, it tells us, and the Jews believe in this, it adds a word that into the text of our scriptural text in the Jewish Targum that says, Xerxes or Ahasuerus called for his wife to come show her naked beauty to the men, and she refused. And all of you would too. In those days, a woman who was with child, a round yon woman with child. You know, that's what they say about Mary. Round yon. Isn't that how that song goes? Round yon virgin mother. Well, when you're with child, the round yon had a meaning back then. It was meant that she was pregnant. Those women did not even leave the house. They were never seen by any man except their husbands or other women. She was not going to show herself in this banquet with the men. So she refuses. Well, the six princesses that are under Xerxes just have a fit. What are we going to do? King, your wife, your queen has refused to come to you. Why, if you don't do something about it today, all the women in the world, which is the Persian Empire, and all of our wives are going to treat us the same way, and they're going to stop doing what we ask them to do. Oh, my goodness. Hasn't the world changed? Those seven men are going to become very important because those princesses say to him, look, if you don't do something, we're going to have trouble throughout our kingdom with all these women uprising against us. Xerxes, you need to oust Vashti as your queen, and you need to put an edict in place that says all the men in all of the empire are the rulers of their household. So, in his drunken rage, Xerxes agrees. He ousts Vashti. She's with his child. He outs her. And he writes the edict, and it goes out through all the provinces and the 127 provinces, and he stamps it with his signet ring to say that it is his, and there it's gone. And then as we open up chapter 2, verse 1, the scripture says this, and it's in the black in the intro. It says, and King Xerxes remembered Vashti and what he had done and what had been decreed against her. In other words, when the wine that he had made merry with, which was in the previous scripture, wore off, The edict was gone. The law of the Medes and Persians could not be broken. And lo and behold, he cannot go see his beauty, Vashti, and she cannot come see him. However, fortunately, he did not put in the edict that she should die for breaking the king's command, which was a normal thing to put in an edict, because she was with child with Xerxes' son. They didn't know he was a son at that point in time. Didn't know if it would be a boy or be a girl. But she was just not allowed to come into his presence, and he could not go to her presence, because if he did, he would break the law of the Medes and the Persians, and then how would the people have faith in him as the king? In other words, Xerxes kind of regretting what had happened during his drunken rage. And evidently, he said something about it enough times that his attendants that are around him, that help him, the eunuchs and all, make a suggestion to Xerxes. And here it is in verse 2. Then the king's attendants who served him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to Susa, the capital, to the harem, into the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti." And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. We can't get you to stop thinking about Vashti. Let's get some other beautiful young maiden in front of you and let her take your mind off of him. Isn't that the way men think sometimes? You women shake your heads up and down. Yep, it's the way men hadn't changed. Nothing has changed, has it? In your short lives that all of y'all have lived, is that not the way it's always been? Just, okay, get over her and find somebody else. Another young little floozy can come along and just take your mind off her and it soothe all your ailments inside of you. Can this be replaced by another young little lady coming along? I am not real happy about this lesson. And neither if I'm real happy about it being in the Bible, but it's the way it was. Can you believe these attendants have suggested that they go out in the 127 provinces and bring in all the beautiful women to put in the harem that is already in place by Hegai? In other words, in the time span of which Xerxes is unhappy, Xerxes has already gone through all of his harem already, and there is no one in his harem of women to satisfy him to be the queen. He needs Jesus. Good opportunity. Yes, he needs the Lord. That's right. Yeah, I testify to that. You need to understand, in these days, all the way through Europe to China to Ethiopia to the bottom part of Africa, the top part of what we would call Russia today, all over the known world, all rulers had harems. Oh, yes, they had their queens, but they also had a harem. They had a harem that the queen looked over, and these women in these harems would be attached to the king in some form or fashion. Now, the harem of Hegai, this harem, is for the virgin women, and they are going to have to go through a 12-month regiment of beautification. Well, the truth of the matter is Xerxes already has his harem of virgin women, and none of them have satisfied him to be the queen. None are as beautiful as Vashti. Now, I want you to understand how long we're taking here. 486 B.C., he becomes the king. 483 B.C., he ousts Vashti as queen. Esther is not going to come in to meet him and to be in his chamber for him to select her until 479 B.C., when she becomes a new queen. He's gone 4 years without a queen wife. Add that up. How many women out of the virgin harem have possibly gone into him for him not to select them? Think about this. This is the way the world was back in those days, and I'm not sure that it's too much difference at this point in time. Now, Little is known about Hegai, the king's chamberlain, who takes care of the virgin harem that he has. Remember, I'm making an emphasis on that. It's the virgin harem. These women have never been with a man before. And listen, when the order goes out to bring in these women, no parent dares to go against it, because if a young lady meets the criteria to be put in the king's harem, to go against the king's order, the parents will be killed. Number two, once the young maiden goes into the king's virgin harem, the parents know that they will never see them again unless they are elevated to some special provision. They go into a harem that is a very clean place, but they live in very tight quarters. The only way that I can give you a visual picture about this is many of y'all have seen, for instance, hospitals during the time of the Civil War, where it was literally one bed next to another, just boom, 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 boom. As many as you can squeeze into one spot, it's one woman right after next, at the next, at the next, and they are in that harem purely for the pleasure of satisfying the king when he calls for them. Well, Hegai is the chamberman, and usually the eunuchs are repulsive-looking men. And in fact, every name means something in these stories, and the name Hegai is the Persian name that means repulsive. His name means that he's repulsive to look at. Therefore, this is a man that the king feels sure that he has no worries with the women that are under his control because he is so repulsive. But still, at that point in time, they have to play the game. They have to do what Hegai says to them so that they can gain his favor, because he is taking care of the king's harem chamber of the virgins, and he can actually control what happens of who goes to the king and who doesn't. Well, going on, verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, this Kish, the son of Benjamin, had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been in exiled with Jeconiah, that's Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. Nebuchadnezzar pulled Jeconiah out. He did that in 587 B.C. It goes on, and Mordecai was bringing up Hadashah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. Now the young lady was beautiful in form and face, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. You see the chart there? That makes it easy for you to look at. See, it says Kish. Kish is the Benjamite. He was taken out at the same time Jeconiah was taken out in 587 B.C. Kish's son was Shimei. Shimei had two sons, Jair and Abihail. And then Jael had Mordecai, Abihail had Esther, but Abihail had died, and so had his wife. And so Mordecai and Esther are first cousins. But evidently, Mordecai is older than Esther by some means. He has an established home, a wife, and he brings her in as if she is a daughter. And when she brings her in, her name, her Hebrew name is Hadashah. But as soon as she is put into the virgin harem, her name is going to be changed to Esther. Esther is the Persian name for the star Venus, the goddess that they worship, the fertility goddess Venus. In the Chaldean, the word is Eshtar. By the way, that's the fertility goddess. By the way, we have taken, thank you Catholics for doing this for us, Catholics decided to fight the grand day of the worship of Eshtar because it occurred around the crucifixion time of Christ. And so the Catholics decided to eliminate the world of the worship of Eshtar by calling the crucifixion time Easter, or Esther, Easter, you got it, from Eshtar, and putting the emphasis on that time. And they were successful doing it. By the way, they did the same thing with Christmas. That was the rebirth of Molech, who died every year just before the fall and was reborn about December the 25th of every year, or the winter solstice, 22nd, 23rd, 24th, 25th, whenever that happened. And he was reborn to live again and then die in the fall. And the Catholics did that for us and successfully moved Christmas in and took the worship of the birth of Moloch really off of the table in the entire world. They did not do very well with Halloween. In fact, the day before All Saints Day, and they didn't do well with anything, but they did well with Easter and with Christmas. And here, Esther is the name for Venus. It is to show the incredible beauty that she has. When Hadassah walks in, Hegai probably is the one who gives her the name and says, "Oh, Esther." Hadashi means myrtle, like a myrtle tree. Esther means Venus. She is beautiful. And that first meeting, I'm sure, causes Hegai to say, there's something special about you. I bet the king's going to like you. Oh, you are so beautiful. So it came about that when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to Susa, the capital, into the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him, so he quickly provided her with cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Nothing but the hand of God could do that. Did the rest of the virgin maids have handmaids to help them? No. Oh, no. 7 maids to take care of her every need. Whenever she needed her feet rubbed, to rub her feet, to rub them with some sort of oil to get the calluses off of them, to cut her toenails, to massage, moisturize her calves and her arms and her hands and her fingernails and her skin, and comb her hair for her and take care of her beauty. And some of your women saying, "How come my husbands can't do that?" Right. They're going to go through a regiment, a beauty regiment for a year, and Esther's going to get special treatment in a special place. She's not going to have to be with all the rest of the herd of maids in this virgin harem. Verse 10, Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed that she should not make them known. Mordecai says, "Don't tell anybody you're a Jew. Please don't." Now you say, how did they not know she's a Jew? I'm going to tell you how they didn't know she's a Jew. Remember when we talked about everybody coming off the boat with Noah? And Shem and his family went one way. Japheth's family went another way. Ham's family went another way. The Israelites and the Chaldeans and the Persians are all cousins. They're all descendants of Shem. She's the right color. She looks like all the rest of them. There's nothing different in her skin color and the people of the Persian people. She fits right in. She's like all the rest of the virgins in the harem, except for she is really, really a knockout. And this old, repulsive-looking man goes, "Esther, you're beautiful. You're as beautiful as the goddess Venus." Oh, my soul. Verse 11, and every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. There he is, cousin, worried about his cousin. How's she doing in the harem? So he goes to where he knows she is and she walks back and forth. I'm sure he did not sit down there, because had he sat down and paused himself and just sat on his haunches to see what he could find out, he probably would have been dealt with by the king or by the king's men. But no, he just walks by the window, walks back by the window, walks just to hear what's going on. If you were a mama or daddy in those days and your daughter was there, I'm sure you'd be trying to walk back and forth before the window to see how your daughter was too, because you're never going to see her again. When she left Mordecai's home, he was promised that he would never see her again unless something special happened. Now, when the turn of each young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus, and that is Xerxes, after the end of her 12 months under the regulation for women, and here's the regulation, for the days of her beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and with cosmetics for women. The young lady would go into the king in this way. Anything she desired was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. Now, here's this beauty treatment, and I'm going to start it myself. See if I can become as beautiful. It's not going to work, is it? My wife's grandmother and my mother-in-law's mother, who is sitting right over here, when she'd come in every night, she'd take this cold cream, and she'd lather it all over her face. And I'd just watch her do this. She didn't care who was there. She'd do it at the table. She'd do it at the bed. Where? Lather it all over there. I guess she did it every day of her life, didn't she? Case talked about this. And then she'd take this towel, and she'd wipe it all off. And then she'd take just a little bit more, and she'd put it all over her face. And it'd be all shiny and glowy. And she would go to bed with a towel, I think, I wrapped around her head. I don't think I ever remember any wrinkles on her face. Now, she had wrinkles other places. I mean, you start here, and you go on her arms and legs. She was wrinkled up. But right here, she just... ooh, just beautiful. My wife has said many times, I need to get that stuff and put it all over my face every night. And we've talked about that many times. She tells me I need one of those facial beauty cosmetic. I'm not so sure if all of us did not go home and get some oil of myrrh, that may be oil of Olay today, and wipe it all over our face for 6 months. Put it on your feet to soften them up, get rid of those calluses and all that type of stuff too, and on your hands, and then follow with 6 months of spices and cosmetics. Now, they didn't have it back in those days, but get you one of those little sprayers, you know, so you can put your makeup on with spray, be nice and light, and you can put all sorts of different perfumes on you, get you a little olive oil and put a little Tabasco sauce in it and do something with, you know. In those days, they believed, since most of the food that everybody ate was very coarse and they put lots of spice, the more coarse the food was, they believed that that caused you to perspire more and to have a more of an odor. And so they would put you on a regimen in those days of not only the outside, but the inside of easily digestible foods along with everything else and spice, and they'd clean you up and it'd take about a year. Now, some of you guys... I've been with you out when you've been sweating, Charlie, and Fred, and some of the rest of y'all, and this would be good for y'all to eat better digested food and to put some oil of some sort on you that smells better. A mild diet, and in most cases, it did promote good health. So at the end of the 12th month, the young woman would think up and dream up, okay, what am I going to wear to go in and see the king, for it's my night? And so she would ask whatever she desired, and it was available to her. The king's eunuch, Hegai, would go and get it. If she wanted a certain dress, a certain set of pearls, a certain set of necklaces, a certain smell, a certain this, a certain that, a certain pair of 6-inch high heel pumps. I don't think they had those back in that days, but they had done something. It was all available. In other words, what he is saying is her wish is her command for this one night. And so they would ask for it when it came her time. Verse 14, this is a sad passage to me, but it is a true passage. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem. Oh, she doesn't get to go back to the first harem. She doesn't get to go back to Hegai's harem, where she's been for at least a year, and maybe longer. She has to go to a second harem, a harem that's in the custody of Shaasgaz. The king's unit, who is in charge of the concubines. What does that mean? That knowledge means she's no longer a virgin, and she cannot go back to the virgin harem. Now she's going to the concubines. She is one of the concubine women that belongs to the king at this point in time. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. She's been used by the king. If he liked her, he'll ask her back. If he doesn't, she's going to stay in the harem of the concubines. And even if she bears a child from the king, that child has no claim to the throne, and neither does she, unless the king bestows it on the child. And as long as that concubine lives, she's going to stay in that clean but tight quarters, concubine harem, plus the child will grow up there until the child is able to go into the service of the king in some job. Descend of the king, but no authority, no inheritance to the throne, unless the king bestows it upon him. 479 B.C. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, that's where we get his name, the uncle of Mordecai, who had been taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king. Listen to what Esther does. She does not request anything except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. It is now 479 B.C. Xerxes has not had a queen for at least 4 years. And it's Esther's turn. Esther does not care what she looks like as she goes in to see the king. She has no desires or pride in her own heart to decide what she needs to wear. She lets Hegai, the eunuch, dress her. She lets Hegai present to her what she should take to see Xerxes. She says, "Just as I am, without one plea. I have no request," she says. "It's my turn to go, and I will go just as I am. But Hegai, you're the eunuch, you're in charge. You dress me the way that you think is best for me to go to see the king." And he does. Verse 17. And the king loved Esther more than all of the women. And she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. When the morning arrives, does Esther go back to the harem of the concubines? Probably not. I think it happened that night. I think before the night was over, he went over and he got the queen's crown and he came and put it on Esther's head. She is now in charge of all the virgin women of Hegai's harem and all the concubine women of Shaaskaz's harem, the concubine harem. She's in charge. That's who she rules over. She's queen. She has been chosen. The king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. That is not the normal procedure. You don't see it here. We have to find it in Persian history. When a king takes a queen as a wife, he always extracted 10% of the normal yearly tax from all the people to endow the queen in her position so that she could take care of everything under her control. One town would provide her with gold. One would provide her with her silver. One would provide her with her pearls. One would provide her with her gowns. One would provide her with the bankroll to take care and feed all the women under her control, and so on and so on and so on. It was called the queen's gold. It was called the time where they would pull in all this money. Xerxes does not do that with Esther. In this case, Xerxes breaks the custom and he gives gifts to everyone. Do you think that doesn't set Esther up as a favorite queen of all the people? Surely when they pulled out all the women, all the young maidens, the people are going, "Oh no, it is going to cost us another 10% whenever he selects somebody. Oh, my soul. Oh, how long? Is it going to be this year? Or perhaps it's going to be next year. We got to start saving up because we got to pay this queen's tax that's going to happen to us when he selects a queen. No, 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 no. Xerxes gives gifts out of his bounty to everyone else. Verse 19, and when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gates. It's funny how lines like that just pass through. All of y'all just missed what happened, didn't you? When the virgins were gathered together a second time, the virgin harem is empty. They're going to make another pass through the entire empire of Persia to pull out a new crop of beautiful virgin women to fill up the virgin harem again. It's been 4 years. Add that up. 354 days in a year back in those years, not 365, times four. How many virgins have gone through the process or possibly gone through the process? At one a night. They have got to reestablish the virgin harem, which all the kings of all those days always had. And Mordecai is sitting at the gate when they gather them all and start bringing them in. Why is Mordecai at the gate? I'm wondering that. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her as she had done under his care. Why is Mordecai at the gate? What authority does he have to be at the gate? Looking on, verse 21. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teshri, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Perhaps Mordecai is in some political position in the king's organization, and so he's able to be at the gate. Perhaps Mordecai is some leader, being a Benjamite from the tribe of Benjamin, which there are two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, they're taken out in that southern kingdom deal, and the remnant from the north that had run away before the northern kingdom had fallen. Perhaps Mordecai is a leader, and Xerxes just says, okay, Mordecai, handle your stuff for the Jews at the gate. Listen, from the time of creation, when Nineveh was formed and when all of Babylon was formed, when they come down from the ark and all of that, from the time of all that, they always did business at the gate. It was handled at the gate. It really wasn't handled in a court system. It was at the gate is where records were handled and shoes were passed from each other to show that a piece of property had been sold or a marriage had been confirmed or whatever. That was all happened at the gate. And so for some reason, Mordecai is at the gate, but we don't know why. But he's allowed to be there. And evidently, he's been there long enough that these two guards, Bigtha and Teshrish, have become comfortable enough that Mordecai's around, that Mordecai is able to hear what they're saying about killing the king. Or perhaps they've tried to enlist Mordecai because he's been there all the time. He's there every day at the king's gate. We don't know what the situation is, but Mordecai finds out about it. He tells Queen Esther, because she's the queen and he can talk to her and she can talk to him because she's got this special position. And the queen tells the king, well, looky here. Now, when the plot was investigated, verse 23, and found to be true, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the books of the Chronicles in the king's presence. He hangs them. And then he says, okay, scribes, bring my chronicles. Now, the chronicles are the records of everything that the king has done. Everything. Everything he commands, everything he does, it's all written in his chronicles. And he says, write down in the chronicles that I hung those two traitors from my government, and I did it because Mordecai let me know what was going on. And they put Mordecai's name in there. That's going to be very important at the end of next week's lesson. Not this week's lesson. Not the beginning of next week's lesson. At the end of next week's lesson. Don't you want to miss it. Don't miss it. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. We are in 474 now. How long has Esther been queen? You see it? Esther's been queen, 479. It's now 474. She's been queen for about 5 years. This all just doesn't roll out here. How after these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hamathdatha, the Agite, and advanced him and established his authority over all princesses who were with him. That is a very important point. Xerxes has lost two people who he has killed out of his organization. He replaces both of them with one by the name of Haman. And oh, by the way, he's just going to take the opportunity while he's changing up his organization to give Haman another job description, a little more authority. He places him, Haman, over those princesses who had given him the bad advice back in 483 BC. You see, back in Esther chapters 1, verse 14, those princesses are the ones that say, hey, you can't do this. You can't allow Vashti to do this. You think Xerxes has not remembered the wrong that was caused by cause of these princesses that always, according to the chapter 1, were able to be in the king's presence anytime they wanted to come or go? It wasn't breaking the law for them to come and go, so they could be there. Now the king says, okay, since I'm getting rid of these two guys and I'm replacing them with Haman, Haman, I want you to be over these princesses of mine also. So you're going to be my buffer between them and me. So they'll have to come to you first. You're going to be their boss. Isn't it funny how things change when you give bad advice? And in those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, and all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, because he's second in control of the kingdom. For so the king had commanded concerning him. When you all see Haman coming, bow down and worship him. Pay homage. That's what homage is. Pay worship him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him that he would not listen to them, and they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reasoning would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Mordecai, you got to bow. It's the king's command. I am not bowing before Haman. I am not bowing before the king. I do not worship anybody but the Lord God, he is saying. And so they tried and tried, and he wouldn't bow, so they're going to talk to Haman about it. And when Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. Pride. Pride brought him the rage. The rest of the world is bowing down to him, but he's bothered because one person, one little thing. You ever let one little thing get under your craw? Just under your skin? Just bother the dickens out of you? All the rest of your life is going just perfect, but there's just this one thing. And you're so OCD over that one thing, it ruins everything else that's going on in your life and all the relationships that are around you, and you can't get off of it. Husbands, do not elbow your wives. Does it ever bother you? You ever do that? You can't see all the good for this one little thing. Haman can't see all the good because of this one little Jew. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. He wasn't just willing to just to do something with Mordecai because he was a Jew. No, he wanted to do it to all the Jews just because of Mordecai. He was going to teach them all a lesson. For they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. What control does Mordecai have over Haman? Doesn't Haman have the authority as second in command to do something about Mordecai? What is the deal here? There's something wrong here because the king has ordered that everyone worship Haman when he comes to the gate and to bow to him, and Mordecai doesn't, so surely there's some authority to do something about Mordecai. Haman doesn't choose to handle Mordecai by himself. He wants to handle the entire Jewish population. And by the way, every known Jew in the world at that point in time was in the Persian kingdom. Haman wants to eradicate every Jew in the world because of Mordecai. So in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. It's 474 B.C. And Haman doesn't know when the right time to go in and talk to King Xerxes about this is. He wants to know, when's the best day? So he brings in the people who are casting dice. And they cast the dice or the sticks or they whatever. They cast the pearl. They cast the lots to see if... And day after day after day after day for 12 months, it keeps saying, no, 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 no. Today's not the day. And finally, in the 12th month, they say, oh, today's the day. It's been 12 months. So what does Haman do? Verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there are certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of our people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasury. Basically saying, I want to make sure I get government a credit for this, so I'm going to pay the men to do it, but the men are going to give it to your treasury. Then the king took his signet ring from his hand, and he gave it to Haman. He takes off his signet ring. It's going to emboss the wax on the edict that's going to be written in all the different languages, and that way they'll know it's from the king. He gives that signet ring to Haman, who is the enemy of the Jews, verse 11. And the king said to Haman, the silver is yours and the people also to do with them as you please. There's the answer I asked you a while ago. He's second in charge. He can do whatever he wants. Do as you please. The people are yours. And by the way, keep the money. We don't need the money. I don't need 10,000 talents of gold in my treasury. Look, I've already showed the world what I've got. I've got more than needed. In fact, out of my bounty and abundance, I've given all my kingdom different little gifts. Whenever I brought Esther on, I don't need your 10,000 talents of gold. Then the king's scribes were summoned. This is 473. It's the first year on the 13th day of the first month. And it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to their language, being written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Well, mercy, let's just let go of our power and delegate it. Haman wrote a letter, an edict, in the name of the king, as if the king was writing it, had it stamped with the king's signet ring in every language. The Ethiopians received in Ethiopians, the Syrians received in Assyria, Syrian, the Chaldeans, the Babylonians received it in Chaldea, and every other language of the people. The Egyptians learned it in Egyptian, etc., etc., and all the 127 provinces in every language received the same edict, and it gets sent out on the 13th day of the first month of 473 B.C. Verse 13. And the letters were sent by courier to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. A copy of the edict is to be issued as law in every province, was published to all the people so that they should be ready for this day. The couriers went out impelled by the king's command while the decree was issued in Susa, the capital, and while the king and Haman sat down to drink. The city of Susa was in confusion. The decree goes out and says, in 11 months, in exactly 11 months from this day, not in next year, but in the last month of this year, every Jew is to be killed, be annihilated in the Persian Empire. And so out they go. It's going to take up to 90 days to get to the furthest point in the kingdom when the couriers are riding as fast as they can to get it there, to wherever it's going. This is a major deal. This is a major process. And out goes the word. But in Susa, they receive that word that very day. And while Haman goes in to sip his wine with the king and probably to give the signet ring back to the king that has stamped all of those decrees and edicts, He's sipping his wine. The whole town of Susa is in confusion. Let me tell you what that confusion may be about. First of all, how would you like to be a people that's in the kingdom that's owned by the Persians? There's no other kingdoms of the world that where you can run to. You can run, but you cannot hide because you are a Jew, and the Persian king owns absolutely everything that you can get to on land is under his control. And you know that 12 months from that day, or however many months from the time that you see, there's an edict posted on the tree or a wall that says you're going to die on a certain day on the last month, on the 13th day of the last month of that year. What are you going to do? And then you've got this kind of confusion. I'm Persian, but I married a Jewish woman. Is my wife going to be killed? And we've got kids. The kids are half-breeds. They're half Persian. They're half Jew. They're half Chaldean, they're half Jew. They're half Ethiopian, they're half Jew. They're half Egyptian, they're half Jew. They're half Syrian. You see the problem? Jews are all over the known world, all over the Persian Empire. Every place you go, Macedonia, what we call Greece, Turkey, Syria, Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia, the Arab states, wherever there are, there's Jews there. And believe me, Jews have intermarried. This is a state of confusion. Be careful what you sign on a letter and send out that you do not know what the repercussions will be because you've not thought it through. And in Susa, they're in confusion. Verse 1 of chapter 4, you know, Esther doesn't have good chapter breaks, so I got to stop somewhere, and I can't stop on chapter 3. I got to go to verse 2 of chapter 4. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes. He put on sackcloth and ashes, and he went out into the midst of the streets and wailed loudly and bitterly. And he went as far as the king's gate. He knows the king's gate. He's been there every day. For no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. He puts on the dress of the poorest of the poor. He takes dust and he throws it all over him. He takes the soot of ashes and he rubs it all over him. And in this horrible, filthy dress, he goes to the place you are not allowed to go to, the king's gate, and he goes there and he wails and he cries because of the edict and the decree that he has learned about there on the 13th day of Nisan. What is he going to do? How is God going to answer this? How is God going to fix this? The decree has gone out. The law of the Medes and the Persians cannot be broken. It is going to happen on the 13th of Adar of 473 AD. It looks like all hopes are dashed. But let me tell you this, folks. In the midst of being where you think there's absolutely nowhere to turn for an answer, God is still in control. And he can answer in the most unique ways, which we'll find out next as we go through Esther chapter 4 and chapter 5.